There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. He turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. This show is all about President Trump's complicated legal issues. They bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and Twitter and whether and when subpoenas are optional. It was clear we needed to devote some time every week to answering some of these big legal questions. So I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
Before we get into specifics, I want to talk broadly about the president's semi-new strategy regarding congressional investigations, which is essentially to fight everything. Fight every subpoena, file lawsuits to stop third parties from complying with subpoenas, fight every document disclosure by government agencies, direct employees and former employees to also not cooperate. And a thing that strikes me is this is a strategy available to any party to a dispute. You can always file lots of lawsuits, resist court orders, etc. Often there are reasons not to pursue this strategy. In this instance, is it an approach that is likely to serve the president's goals?
It may, simply because we're dealing again here with this gulf we've been talking about from the start of this show between good legal strategy and good public relations strategy. The president has been relatively effective, at least with his base, in pushing this narrative that the entire inquiry into his behavior is a witch hunt, that it's a Russia hoax, and that it's all just interfering with his ability to lead awesomely. So he may care less about the fact that a lot of these tactics are ultimately unlikely to work in court, and care more about the idea that this delays Congress and its investigations and gives his base more of the narrative they crave, which is that he's the victim of unlawful and unreasonable investigations.
But I can think of three reasons besides public relations that obstinacy might be in the president's interest. One is that, you know, delays might be tantamount to victory in certain ways. We only have 18 months until the election. The courts move slowly about a lot of things. In some cases, simply delaying might successfully prevent Congress from obtaining a lot of the things it's looking for, I would think, until after the election. You also have the question of whether there are, you know, there's a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. We'll talk about this a little bit later in this show, but I think there's some sense among both the president's supporters and his detractors that that might help him get favorable rulings there. And then finally, in some cases, his claims are not ridiculous, and he has, you know, he has colorable arguments that he actually is entitled to not comply with certain requests.
You know, I think that those three points are colorable, although I don't agree with them completely. I think that the delay factor certainly it can push things out, but courts tend to address these types of delays, things having to do with assertions of privilege and other refusals to comply with congressional subpoenas, more promptly than typical litigation. So generally, the time we have before the election is enough to adjudicate something like this. With respect to the Supreme Court, and we can talk about this more, I think that the optimism that people on the Supreme Court are going to rule in a purely partisan fashion on this type of issue is probably somewhat overblown. It's not so much a substantive, hardcore, conservative legal issue as the president might think or hope.
So let's get into some of the objections, and let's start with some where I think the president may actually have a plausible legal argument to win on the merits. Let's start with whether Don McGahn should have to produce documents he generated while he was White House counsel and was preparing to speak with the special counsel. These have been subpoenaed by a Democratic-controlled congressional committee. The White House has objected to McGahn's production, and McGahn has basically said, these documents aren't mine. They belong to the White House. They're my work product from when I worked there. And in the face of the White House's objection to my producing them, I can't comply with the subpoena yet. You have to go to court, and we're going to have to figure out whether I/the White House should actually have to comply with this subpoena.
Well, McGahn might be right that he's forced to make these objections if his boss directs him to do so. But that doesn't mean that the objections are legally correct. The scope of executive privilege is fairly narrow, and it has to do with communications to advise the president. And it's not clear how these documents would fall into that category. The category for attorney-client privilege is also quite narrow, and it's not clear at all that it would apply to a White House counsel advising the president about this type of thing, because he's not really the president's personal attorney in a criminal investigation, in the special counsel investigation. He's more the White House's attorney. And finally, as to the assertion of work product, that's a narrow doctrine that allows attorneys to refuse to turn over documents that have their personal mental impressions about litigation. But it's not an absolute doctrine. It can be overcome when there's a need shown. So although of all the array of objections currently being made, McGahn's are not the worst, they're not clear winners either.
There's also this issue of waiver. Even if some of these privileges existed, have they already been waived because McGahn spoke with the special counsel and because the special counsel's report was in large part disclosed to the public? And so I think that's been, in the public conception, that's been the thought, is basically, you know, well, the White House chose to waive these privileges. They should have, if they wanted to assert executive privilege, they should have decided at the time that McGahn wouldn't submit for these interviews. They should have objected to release as a part of the report. And then there are some counterarguments to this, which is basically, you know, the White House would say that we didn't waive executive privilege when Don McGahn spoke with Robert Mueller because Robert Mueller is part of the executive branch. It was an intra-branch conversation. We did not release any information outside the executive branch. So to the extent that there are that there's information that's subject to executive privilege, that was preserved from waiver. Then when the report was disclosed publicly, that it only waives the privilege as regards the part that has been disclosed publicly. So maybe you could ask McGahn about things you already know, but if you ask about things that weren't in the report, he might be able to decline to answer those questions. And then there's also this other privilege that I'd never heard of that has to do with a privilege for close presidential advisors to not submit to congressional questioning, just as the president himself does not have to submit to questioning from Congress. And my understanding is there's been very little court review of that claim of privilege, but it has been asserted by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration at various times. So are those things that might mean that McGahn either could refuse to testify, or that if he was brought before Congress, he might have to appear, but he could decline to answer a lot of the questions?
So the waiver argument, Josh, I think is really interesting. And I think the people saying that any executive privilege has been waived have the stronger argument. It's a creative argument that the administration is making, that we didn't actually waive this because we only showed it to other people in our same branch. I don't really think that works, though, because generally you waive privilege, any privilege, if you disclose things to people outside the circle of people who have an obligation to keep it confidential. So, for instance, if you have a conversation with your attorney and you talk about that to your spouse, that doesn't waive privilege because you also have privilege with conversations with your spouse. So there's no disclosure outside the zone of privacy. Here, though, the special counsel clearly did not have the same obligation to keep things private that the other people in the executive branch did. He actually had an obligation to investigate and disclose. So I think the assertion that they didn't really waive anything by saying things to the special counsel is not strong.
Did the special counsel not have an obligation to keep certain things private that is established by Department of Justice regulations and practices, that basically there were certain categories of things that the special counsel would be expected to disclose, for example, if they were relevant to an indictment? But there are other things like derogatory information about uncharged parties that he might have been expected to keep confidential, and that would protect the privilege at least as regards some of the information that was told to the special counsel?
Probably not, because those categories are in the special counsel's discretion. So the closest analogy is that when I, as an attorney, interview an employee of one of my client companies, then that employee might say, well, Ken, generally you have an obligation to keep your company's information private, so you should treat the conversation with me as privileged. And my response is, well, no, because I'm the company's lawyer, not your lawyer, and I have the decision about what's best for the company in terms of what to disclose or not. That's kind of the position the special counsel is in here, to decide what to disclose, except for things as to which there are clear rules, like grand jury secrecy, to decide what is appropriate to disclose to the attorney general and from there to Congress. So I don't think it's a strong argument. And as you said, the argument about this close presidential advisor privilege is very unsettled. And generally, we've had both the president and Congress back off from the brink rather than have a real legal contest over it in the past when people have brought it up.
Let's talk about the escalating fight between Attorney General Bill Barr and Jerry Nadler, who's the Democratic chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Nadler has issued a subpoena for the unredacted Mueller report and the supporting documents behind the report. The Justice Department has refused to comply with that subpoena. The House Judiciary Committee has thus raised the prospect of holding Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress for refusing to produce the report. And then DOJ was saying, well, if you try to do that, we're going to have the White House assert executive privilege over the entire unredacted portions of the report and the supporting documents for that. And then on Wednesday morning, just as we were taping, the White House, in fact, did make that assertion of privilege. So what is going to be the resolution of this fight between Barr and Mueller? Because my recollection is that you actually think the Department of Justice has a pretty good argument, at least as regards some of this, that there is grand jury information in the redacted portions of this report and that it would, in fact, be illegal for the Department of Justice to disclose that information to Congress or to the public.
I think there's a colorable argument there, yes, because the rules for maintaining grand jury secrecy are strict and the exceptions to those rules are limited. And it's not clear that they would apply to a request from Congress. So there's some language in there about turning over grand jury information to an attorney for the government, doing their job for the government. And some argue that would apply to counsel for various committees in Congress. But it is not 100% clear, and courts have recently said, look, this is the law and the exceptions are what they are, and courts can't just create new exceptions. But that only applies to the grand jury material in the special counsel's report. This assertion that everything in there unredacted is somehow executive privilege, I think, is barely serious, if serious at all. It's sort of a boilerplate objection where you just throw in everything you could possibly say, every word you know that is an objection to turning something over. I don't think there's a colorable argument that the entire unredacted portion is executive privilege, which again applies to things that are involved in giving advice to the president by advisors. And a lot of this is stuff that comes from other sources entirely.
Yeah. So, I mean, for example, I guess the classified information would be where you might have a stronger executive privilege argument, because that's, you know, that information for the purposes of, you know, an intelligence determination that might be made by the president. But then the harm to ongoing matter stuff, where like we need to not disclose this because it could interfere with Roger Stone's prosecution, there might be a valid interest there from DOJ, but it wouldn't have anything to do with executive privilege.
Right. And similarly, the security stuff is really not executive privilege either, because it might be information that the president would want to know in national security situations, but that's not the source of the information or the context of the information. So Congress isn't saying, hey, presidential advisors, come in and tell us what you told the president about these issues. That would be executive privilege. But this freestanding report that has national security information that the special counsel obtained from other sources, that's not executive privilege.
Let's talk about the prospect of Robert Mueller testifying. So Bill Barr has said publicly that he does not intend to interfere with Robert Mueller testifying before Congress, that he's happy to let him do that. The president had previously said that that was fine. Now the president has changed his mind. He has said that Robert Mueller should not testify. I think there's an important bit of language to parse there. He is not ordering Robert Mueller to testify. Robert Mueller, I actually hadn't realized this, is still an employee of the Department of Justice. Won't be for long, but for some number of days or weeks, he will continue to be an employee. And so theoretically, at least, the president could instruct him that he is not to testify. The president hasn't done that yet. If he wanted to, would he be able to stop Robert Mueller from testifying before Congress?
Well, in theory, he could direct him as a continuing employee of the Department of Justice not to testify, but it's not clear that that would prevent him from testifying. And Congress can call him in and say that basically your excuse, the president told you not to, is not good enough. And if he refuses, go through the normal remedies they have for contempt or other refusing to comply with Congress. I mean, the president could also fire him from whatever last few remaining days of service he has, which again wouldn't stop him from testifying. Even if he does testify, I think we have to keep in mind that Robert Mueller is not the superhero that people dream of who's going to take down Donald Trump. I think there's no reason to believe that he won't continue to show the same cautious, rule-bound, and circumspect nature that he demonstrated in the special counsel report by, for instance, refusing to come out and say, oh yeah, this dude obstructed justice, you should impeach him or he should be charged. I think he's going to continue to be Robert Mueller fundamentally, even if he's under oath in front of Congress.
Well, let's take a quick break and then come back and talk about that. You are listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with Attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. And we've been talking about the prospect that Special Counsel Robert Mueller will soon testify before congressional committees. And so you're getting to a key question here, which is if he is called to testify and if he agrees to testify and the White House is not able to stop him from testifying if they choose to try to stop him, what is he even going to say? And so I think, you know, one thing that will happen is you'll have Democratic members of the committee trying to get him to repeat things that we already know that are in the report so that we will have video of Robert Mueller saying them, which will be damaging. But what are some new things that you would hope that the committee might try to learn from Robert Mueller that he might actually talk about if he's asked?
Well, what they may do is ask him for his reaction to the rather vague analysis by Barr and Rosenstein that there was no obstruction of justice by the president, that the evidence was insufficient. And it's not clear whether he'll agree to answer that question. He may think it's not his place. But Congress may look for a deeper analysis of, were it not the president, would you have recommended indictment of this person? They may ask for clarification of some of the other things we've talked about, like, is it your position that there was no evidence of unlawful coordination with the Russians or simply insufficient evidence? They may, in effect, cross-examine him and say, you say there is no collusion, no conspiracy, no coordination, but isn't it true that you found these three things happened? And wouldn't you agree that that's evidence of illegal coordination with the Russians? I would also expect them to spend some time on the infamous Trump Tower meeting and Don Trump Jr. and the analysis of why he could not be charged for accepting a thing of value from a foreign power. Basically, anything that reflects badly on Trump or the Trump Organization or family, I expect them to ineffectually gesture at.
One thing that just strikes me here is that Robert Mueller is a very precise person. Who seems to, in this report, have figured out precisely what he wanted to disclose and did not want to disclose. And in particular, he made this decision that nobody really seems to like, to make no prosecutorial recommendation as regards the obstruction of justice issues. And you have some people from the right who basically say, well, that was inappropriate. It's the job of the prosecutor to decide to prosecute or not. You had some people from mostly the left who look at it and say this is tantamount to a prosecutorial recommendation. It has all the necessary elements, and he just, as a matter of formalism, chose not to put that stamp on it. I assume that asked those questions again, he will continue to say only the things that he intended to say there. If he was going to give a satisfying answer to that question, he would have given it in the report. I don't understand why, if he couldn't give it in the report, why wouldn't the same reservations that caused him to make no recommendation in the report cause him not to make it aloud if he testifies before Congress?
Yeah, I would be very surprised if they're able to get him to commit to something verbally that he wouldn't commit to in writing. You know, he made this choice. You can find it a non-convincing choice. I mean, I think that, you know, the second part of the special counsel's report where Mueller says, basically, I'm not going to make a finding or recommendation, but here's all this evidence and people can make charts of it. And it certainly seems to show that the president obstructed justice. I don't find that terribly convincing. you know, I think the rhetorical term is apophasis, where you say you're not going to raise something in order to raise it. And that seems to be somewhat what Robert Mueller did in that phase two of the special counsel report, to say I'm not going to make a recommendation, but make what sure appears to be a recommendation. But I don't think he's going to move off of that. He's stubborn and determined and very rule-bound, and he seems to have convinced himself, rightly or wrongly, that this is the appropriate, responsible way for him to exercise his powers.
Does it matter that nearly 400 former federal prosecutors think that this is something that would be charged if he were not the president? There was this letter that went around, and you know there are a lot of signatures on the letter.
Yeah, I've seen it. There are a lot of former federal prosecutors. I mean, all you have to do is turn on MSNBC and you can see 20 or 30 of them. You know, being a former federal prosecutor doesn't make you magically more credible in your determination of whether or not someone should be charged. And I think that if you got a letter from 400 former federal prosecutors saying that Hillary Clinton should have been charged for you know, mishandling national security information, that people would see that immediately. I think that the letter stands or falls on its analysis, and its analysis of why people are saying that Trump, if he were anyone else, would have been charged, I think is noticeably a lot less substantive and methodical than the special counsel report. So I think it's kind of a appeal from authority for people to say, I'm a former federal prosecutor, and therefore you should trust my judgment that this person would have been charged. I think you should look, speaking as a former federal prosecutor, you should look to the quality of our analysis and how we can back it up, and not to that appeal to authority.
I was interested in this article by Jack Goldsmith, who's a professor at Harvard Law School and was a top lawyer in the Bush White House. He wrote for the Lawfare blog essentially in defense of Bill Barr's handling of the release of the Mueller report, or in defense of most of the aspects of his handling of it. And one of the criticisms he lodges is essentially that Mueller put Barr in a very awkward position by doing what Goldsmith views as this extracurricular thing of making these recommendations in volume two of the report, or actually not making a recommendation, but providing all of this information that appears to lead up to a recommendation and not recommending prosecution. And his view is basically that the job of the special counsel is to either recommend prosecution or not, that the regulations creating the special counsel position do not contemplate the idea that the special counsel does something that is essentially an impeachment referral, laying out information to be handed to Congress to say, here, you decide whether this is something that should be impeached over, and that basically he was doing something that wasn't his job, and that put Barr in this position of A, having to make the prosecutorial decision himself. And then, you know, Goldsmith doesn't say this, but it also conceivably is something that put Barr in the position of feeling the desire to be somewhat publicly defensive of the president.
You know, I think there's some merit to the argument, and I do think that some of the criticisms of Barr are overblown. But with respect to those regulations, Josh, I mean, they're like a page and a half. They really do not contemplate explicitly most things that the special counsel could run across. So this situation is unprecedented historically. And it really wasn't clear what Robert Mueller should do. I think that Barr, yes, some of the things he said were on point and fair. Some of them were not. I think that his morning of release press conference was purely partisan and a complete spin on what the report said. And I think that one or two of his comments in letters were questionable. For instance, and we keep coming back to this, his claim that the refusal to recommend obstruction of justice charges by Mueller were not because of the rule against indicting a sitting president, I think that's clearly wrong and misleading. But overall, I don't think that Barr was as misleading as some people are suggesting.
And to your point there, Goldsmith is not fully defensive of Barr. And one thing he particularly critiques is from that press conference where Barr said that, you know, that there was no collusion, basically, that we can put that to bed. And Goldsmith says this is more or less the same mistake that Mueller made, getting in the business of doing something other than deciding whether to charge crimes. Barr himself, even at another point in that press conference, said, we're not in the exoneration business, complaining about Mueller having this line that said, you know, this report doesn't exonerate the president. And yet there was Barr trying to exonerate the president, again seeming to go beyond the role of a prosecutor.
Right. Well, again, Barr's in a historically unprecedented position, just as Mueller is. So the special counsel regulations and the order appointing Mueller, contemplate this investigation, but they don't spell out exactly what's the content of this report to the Attorney General. And I think that Mueller kind of came up with the best he could, looking at the history and traditions of being a special prosecutor or special counsel and what he thought his obligations were.
When we look at all of these disputes that are ongoing right now, there's a news analysis in the New York Times this week by Adam Liptak, who covers the Supreme Court for them. And it says at the beginning, quote, President Trump's wholesale refusal to provide information to Congress threatens to upend the delicate balance that is the separation of powers outlined in the Constitution, unquote. Does that sound right to you?
I think it's a little dramatic. I think that we've had a lot of presidents assert executive privilege broadly. We had Clinton assert it aggressively in the Monica Lewinsky investigation by Ken Starr. We had President Obama assert it in the Fast and Furious investigation. So Democrats have asserted it. Republicans have asserted it. This particular circumstance may involve a unusually aggressive and broad spectrum refusal to cooperate with Congress. But that may be just simply because of how many things they're investigating and how much wrongdoing they're looking at. So I think the question of whether it threatens the balance of powers depends on what Congress does, whether they have the spine to challenge the administration in court and use the powers they have to try to force the issue, and then how courts handle it. Until then, I think that the two sides pushing back against each other are how it's supposed to work. That is the balance of powers. It's how we resolve it with the rule of law that depends on whether that works or not.
Well, and so that brings us back to something we discussed at the beginning, which is the theory of the White House. And I think it was Newt Gingrich's line that, who obviously isn't in the White House, but he's sometimes close to the White House, that, you know, we'll see whether the Kavanaugh fight was worth it. Seems to be basically that there's a 5-justice conservative majority on the Supreme Court and that that's going to protect them in these fights with Democrats and Congress.
So, I mean, that's optimistic, I think, on Gingrich's part, who, true, is not in the White House, but frequently lurking in the bushes outside. You know, the question is whether this is going to be an outcome like a Bush versus Gore that people are going to see as a purely 5-4 political type outcome, or whether it's going to be something else. And I think the history of assertions of executive privilege and other attempts to resist Congress don't necessarily bear out the concept that it's going to be purely partisan. If you look at the rulings the courts made during Nixon's years, during Clinton's years, during Obama's years, I don't think that you got the sort of reliably purely partisan outcomes that the conservatives are hoping for here.
A lot of those key decisions were unanimous or nearly unanimous.
But, exactly. Yeah. The Nixon decision, the Clinton decision, all those went against the president frequently, and including people from the president's party. So I think that the belief that suddenly we have a much more partisan Supreme Court that will reliably deliver results to conservatives, it could be, but I would not be counting on it if I were them.
I think a key issue here, and I think liberals who buy into this idea that Newt Gingrich is putting out there, that basically these conservative judges are hacks who are going to protect the president. I think a lot of people are looking to the travel ban case there, which was a 5-4 decision. But I think there's a key distinction, which is that in the travel ban case, the conservative justices were striving to treat the Trump administration like a normal presidential administration and giving it broad deference in its assertion of Article II powers under the Constitution and giving it a strong presumption that when it takes policy actions, that those have valid purposes, especially when it's taking those actions under laws where Congress has already granted the president broad latitude to act with discretion, which is the case with visa issuance. The president has very broad powers to decide to stop issuing visas to people from certain countries. And so it was the liberals who had to argue that, no, this is not a normal president. This is a very unusual thing being done for an unusual reason. And so a power that the president would normally be given to discretion to exercise, he should not be given that discretion in this instance. When you look, for example, at the tax returns case, where the president very much wants to stop the disclosure of his tax returns from the IRS to Congress, it almost turns the travel ban case on its head, because that's an area where Congress has extremely broad discretion granted to it in law to request tax returns for any reason. And so it's now the conservative argument is to say, well, maybe the law says they have this power, but their purpose for doing this is so bizarre, this Congress is so out of control and unusual, the courts should irregularly step in and stop them from exercising this power. And I think the conservative judges who were reluctant to do that that in the travel ban case are likely to be similarly reluctant to do that in the tax case. Essentially, they're being asked to answer a political question, whether Congress has a good policy reason for asking for these tax returns, and they could very easily demur on that.
I think you're exactly right. I think that the argument that Congress should be limited from doing things when they have bad motives is completely against the normal red meat conservative legal argument, and that people mistake conservative partisan outcomes in cases where there is a red meat issue like immigration or whatever it is, and assume that it will be transported to other cases where those issues simply aren't present. And one of the reasons, even if you have partisan conservative judges, tend to have their eyes on the long term and the impact of their rulings in other situations that people who aren't judges don't necessarily have. They have a long-term strategy. They have a plan. And giving this sort of ruling where all of a sudden you can second-guess Congress substantively does not help that long-term plan.
There is so much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW and also on Facebook. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is Kat Yore. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.